I made them do it. Oh, I want to express my appreciation to Melanie and John because I gave them three or four song titles to prepare more music than they normally have to prepare for today because I wanted those to sort of lend themselves to the theme I had for the day, and they went out and did it and came up with more as well. So I think they deserve our appreciation. Thank you. And you're going to hear some more of those songs even now, as we go along in my talk. So if you've caught the clues that were there already in the music, my topic for today is going to be apologies and thank yous. Apologies and thank yous. Now, and you'll see how this evolves as I get into this. I see these things as tied to the two upcoming holidays, and that is Halloween and Thanksgiving. Right. Now, and that may not make sense right now, but I hope it will as we get further forward here. There are two different levels, at least, of apologies and thank yous. And one of the first levels, pretty simple, pretty straightforward. You know, we say, I'm sorry, I bump someone's elbow and they slurp some coffee onto the tabletop and I say, oh, I'm sorry, I'll get a towel to help you clean that up. And then, or you step on somebody's toe in an elevator and you say, oh, I'm sorry, I hope you're okay. And then we have thank yous, someone's pauses, stops their car in a long line of cars waiting at a stoplight, and they let you in so that you can get out of that parking lot, and you wave a thank you to them as you pull out and mouth the words thank you. Someone lets you cut in line in front of them at the supermarket because you've got two items and they have a basket full, and so they let you in front of them and you say thank you. And you mean it, of course. That's sincere. But those are easy apologies and thank yous. They roll right off the tongue. We're taught those things from infancy practically. As soon as we can walk and talk, we're taught those rules of civility and sociability. And it's not too hard to do. But I want to talk about a different level of apology and thank you, a different order of magnitude. The apologies and thank yous that are very hard to do. It's like the difference between stepping up on a curb and climbing Mount Everest sometimes. So keeping that in mind, let me go to the first of the holidays, right? Coming up, as we saw earlier, we saw our child going forward here, already in costume, can't wait for the day. As cat girl, right? And so that holiday, of course, Halloween, comes to us in the form, and we most often think of it as a time that we dress up in costume and wear masks, right? We become different people. We try on different shapes and sizes and attitudes, and it's a lot of fun. Of course, if you can remember back to those times when you were a child, okay, this was one of the most exciting times you possibly could have, right? As we could witness here this morning. I mean, we're getting ready for it weeks in advance, right? And we can't wait to put on their costume and put on our mask and we paint our faces and we're going to show our teachers and our, grandma and grandpa and uncles and aunts and everybody, right? And this is pretty exciting. Now, some of you know that my spousal unit over here, Sue Ellen, that she many years ago was a first grade teacher for several years, right? And so she used to tell me that Halloween was the most exciting holiday that kids had. They would go wild. They would all have all kinds of energy bursting out of them, and they couldn't wait to dress up and to come and scare you. I jump at you from out of the closet or whatever, right? It was even more exciting than Christmas to them, right? And those were great times. Now, I'd like you, and I think back to my days as when I went out dressed up at Halloween when I was a kid, and I had my favorite costumes. I had, and my favorites, I'll be honest, were a gunslinging cowboy, right, naturally. And I was also like, loved being, you know, Flash Gordon, Space Ranger, right? Some of you may remember once upon a time, if you're that old, Flash Gordon serials, you know, and TV shows. So, so I'm going to ask you, how many of you remember one of those costumes that was one of your favorite, okay, when you were young? When you were a kid, what was one of your favorite costumes? Just shout it out, one or two words, anybody.
Witch.
Okay, well, that hasn't gone away here, so. What? The blue skin smurf. Okay, well, a hilarious one. Somebody else. Who else?
Cinderella.
What else? I heard something over here. Well, I couldn't.
A cat.
Oh, another cat. Okay, yeah. Anybody else? Okay, all right. Very good, yeah. So we all had our favorites, and sometimes those favorites shifted. So we had the comical costumes and masks. And then we had some of the heroic ones that we put on those faces, and sometimes we had the scary ones, right? Now, then when you grow up, you know, people still like going to Halloween parties and dressing up, right? Even as we become quote-unquote adults, because there's a part of us that doesn't get too adult. And so on Halloween, and especially at a Halloween party, you know, we get real excited, and we dress up, we have costumes, we have the scary ones, you know, the witches and the goblins and the ghosties, and we also have the heroic ones. So we put on our Luke Skywalker outfits, for example, whoever your favorite hero or heroine is. We have the comedy ones. Sometimes couples go as Laurel and Hardy, or buddies and friends go as Laurel and Hardy, right? And then, of course, there are those sexy costumes that, you know, women bring out, okay, and men love it, okay, at Halloween. So they come as that very sexy Catwoman, right? Or there's the sexy pirate, you know, pirate wench, as well. So we put those sides of ourselves on display. But the interesting thing is, you know, we don't seem to do it any other time of the year. I mean, why not have it once a month, have a dress up time, right? When we could come in costume and then a different mask. And I find that very interesting as a proposition, because, okay, and it's kind of interesting because if you think about it, when we put on those other masks, even if it's only just at Halloween, we also take off another mask, because we all have a public self, a persona. You know, in Greek, the word persona actually means mask. In Greek drama, 2,500 years ago, the actors all wore these huge sort of masks that actually amplified their voices so they could be heard in the Greek amphitheaters, where thousands would come outdoors to watch the drama. So we all have this public persona that we present on a daily basis. And how do we get that? Well, you know, it's some of those rules we hear as when we're young, as children. The how to be sociable and civil, certainly. But there are other things, too, that help us develop or force us to develop this kind of public masks that we wear. And if you think about it, the mask comes from those parts of us, certain parts of us being taken away. The parts of us that are not acceptable. You know, if you think back to it, okay, all of us, as children, go through this. First of all, we learn from our parents that we're not, you know, there are certain things we don't do, we don't behave a certain way, we don't say a certain thing, and what happens over time is we realize through various means. Okay, sometimes we're just told, and sometimes we're yelled at, and sometimes we're punished. Because when I was young, you got a whipping too if you know you were misbehaving, right? So what we do is we take those parts of us that are considered unacceptable or ugly, and we put them aside. We push them, sort of into the background, and we try to hide them, right? So we know that those aren't going to be acceptable when we're out in public and as we grow into life. And now, some of you are familiar with a psychologist, Dr. Carl Jung. And Jung did a lot of study, of course, of dreams and myths, from around the world, and he came up with the concept of the shadow. And he said that all of us have a shadow or a shadow self, and that shadow is where we put those parts of ourselves that we are not supposed to have, that we're not supposed to display, that are not acceptable, and that are, and so if we want to be accepted, we have to hide those parts of ourselves. And so we put those parts of ourselves into the shadow, and of course, but the thing is, that shadow can't go away because those parts are parts of the human psyche. We all have them, and you can't kill them. So we try to ignore them. And of course, we face into the light, right? So the shadow is always behind us and we can't see it. Nevertheless, those parts of ourselves are there and they pop up. Okay. Sometimes at inappropriate times. But the interesting thing with those parts of us are that they're necessary parts of us. They're parts of our personality. They're parts of being human, right? So the ambition, okay, sometimes the aggression that takes to get over an obstacle, right? Sometimes the humor, okay? And you may know folks, okay, I know folks too, that have a sense of humor that won't quit, and when it won't quit, we get pretty tired of it pretty quickly, right? They seem to go over the top. And so we try to squash that side of ourselves. The creativity that comes to us as humans that we have also goes sometimes into the shadow, into that bag, because it's not seen, the way we are creative is not seen as acceptable. So those things go into the shadow, but you know what? They can't stay there and forever, and they keep popping up. And so what we do, Jung said, is that we project those things, those parts of ourselves, onto others. You know, in Unity, we often have talked about the fact that the outer world is simply a mirror that mirrors back to us those things, perhaps that we don't like about ourselves. And so when we run into those people in the world out there that seem to be obstacles or enemies, right? Often what we see in them is those parts of ourselves that we don't necessarily like, or that we've learned to sort of not like. So, as we project those things onto others, okay, we tend to operate in sort of a confused state. And we get ourselves into often a defensive state when we are thinking that that person over there is my enemy, my nemesis. And basically, all we're seeing is some aspect of ourselves that we don't necessarily like. And, of course, that's part of the process of projecting onto that other person. So what we do is we sort of try to live with this mask called our public self on, but I think sometimes there are people that don't develop those. And I want to tell you a story about one of those people that I know, right? And this is when I knew him initially, he was a boy. We were boys together, same neighborhood. I grew up in a blue-collar neighborhood. We all went to the same grade school. It was, if we went two houses down and across the street, that was the grade school, right? And, of course, in my neighborhood, naturally, there were some group of boys. There were about four or five of them that hung out together, and that was an early version of a gang, right? And they were mean and tough. Okay, and brutal, and so those of us who were not so mean or tough or are self-confident sort of stayed away from them, and we were the ones that were bullied, okay, and they were the bullies, and kind of a nice social role and arrangement. Everybody knew who was who, right? And Keith was one of those, okay, and so Keith, of course, had this his public mask, okay, his public self was pretty aggressive. He was condescending, he was sarcastic, and he would like to push people around, whether it was on the school grounds or in gym class, okay? That was very typical. And so the rest of us sort of like lived in fear of Keith and his cronies. I'll tell you, one day when I was a little older in grade school, I was about fifth grade then, I think, I was a safety patrol. Were any of you out there safety patrols in your school? Remember that process? Okay. Got to wear a Sam Brown belt with a strap across the body, and it was white. Then I got to take it home and wash it, you know, and it got dirty. We had a little badge on it, and I was so proud of that, right? I was a little cocky and self-righteous about it too, I have to admit, right? So I was on patrol one day at school, and I was on the stairs, guarding the stairs, right? And Keith was came up the wrong stairway. He was going up the downstairs, right? And so I thought, okay, I've got you now, okay? And I nabbed him and took him over to Miss Hopper, who was the gym teacher, and she was about 17 feet tall and very gaunt and angular and tough, you know. And I was very proud. I was so proud. You know, I came up to her and I said, "Oh, Miss Hopper, I caught Keith going up the downstairs." And bam, she cut me off at the knees. She said, "Young man, you do not catch people. You're not there to catch people. Okay, you're there to make sure those stairs are safe." And I was totally deflated, right? So, interestingly enough, in that incident, okay, in knowing Keith, I learned an awful lot, okay? You know, a valuable lesson was taught. For one thing, I realized as I got older, much older, okay, and I had worked a little on myself and my own personality, I realized that, you know, I had no idea what Keith had gone through, how he grew up, what his parents were like. I mean, because his public persona had never gotten beyond one of those private ones that was not acceptable. He lived the bully, okay? He lived that self. But I didn't know what caused that. I didn't know if one of his parents had deserted him. I didn't know if his parents insulted and demeaned and berated him and said he was dumb, he was never going to amount to anything. I did not know if they beat him, okay, when he was at home. So I don't know what led him into that. And so I would say that I actually should have given him an apology. I should have apologized to Keith. I should have said, "I'm sorry." Okay, I didn't know. I didn't know. I didn't understand. Right? Because I hated Keith. I carried that for a long time. And when I got the word from Miss Hopper that I wasn't there to catch people, it occurred to me later on now, and looking back, I realized that, I had one of those ugly masks on, the self-righteous mask, the condescending mask. In my own way, I was being a little bit of a snob, certainly. And so I should be thanking Keith for all the lessons that I learned from him. You know, thank you, Keith. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to learn from you, right? So I owed him an apology, and I owed him a thank you for what he offered me. Thank you. May the road rise to meet you. It has its origins, that song, in an Irish blessing or Celtic blessing. And so I want to propose to you that all apologies and all thank yous, all I'm sorries, all the thank yous that we can issue are really blessings. They carry with them that message and that power. They're healing. They, in fact, heal not only relationships with those others beyond us and outside us, but they also, and this is one of the paradoxes, and there are many in life, but certainly one of the wonderful paradoxes is they also heal us. When we say thank you, we say I'm sorry. Because when we say that to the other, to that other person, and who is wearing a mask also, okay, we're reaching behind the mask and saying we see something there that is other than what they project, the socially acceptable, that they're a full person with many parts, many roles, many aspects to their life. We recognize that, we appreciate, that is to say we value that, and we understand. I'm sorry if I didn't understand, and thank you for the lesson that you're giving me. You're here to give me that lesson. That's what we say in unity. We say that all those people we encounter in our life, even if we think that they're there as our enemy, they have that mask on as we see it, that they're there for a purpose. They're giving us a lesson. Right? They're bringing us a lesson that we have need of. Now, you can say, I'm sorry and thank you not only to those people that we see as the enemy or as the other who are seen as obstacles to us, but you can also say it to people whom we know, who are close to us, who are friends and who are lovers, who are loved ones. And you think, would it be easier to say those words to those people? It's not because we don't have that animosity toward them. And you'd think it would be easy to say those things, right, to those people. But I found that not to be the case. You know, I found sometimes it's as hard to speak those words of blessing to someone that we know, we love, we live with, as it is, okay, to say them to someone that we see as the opposition. Tell you a couple of stories, okay. About this. And first of all, let me say that, you know, the reasons we have trouble sometimes saying these things, I'm sorry and thank you, and there are all kinds of reasons we have that as it works out. Sometimes we just don't have the words we think are the right words. Other times we give ourselves an excuse that, you know, we don't have the time. We'll do that later. Sometimes we say to ourselves, okay, well, that's too embarrassing. That's too intimate. That's not part of our daily conversation. And it's a challenge to step over that abyss, over that mountain, and to take ourselves and that other person to that other level. So let me tell you a story about close friends of ours, of Sue Ellen and mine. Bill and Betty, use their first names. Got to know Bill and Betty right after Sue Ellen got out of her undergraduate work and was going to teach and move to my hometown, Jacksonville. And she was looking for an apartment, and she found this with Bill and Betty. She found an apartment with Bill and Betty, and we lived in their house for was several years, okay, in different circumstances, but I should tell you, Betty was a wonderful person. She grew up on a farm. She knew how to do everything. I was always so amazed and in wonder at her. She could repair a tractor or a car. Okay. She grew her own food. Bill and Betty made their own wine. She was so adept, loved animals. She could and took care of animals. They always healed their own pets and rarely went to the veterinarian. And Betty, as she matured, okay, got into doing selling airplane insurance for private pilots, right? And did that until she retired. Bill, okay, also a native of our hometown, growing up there, was from Portuguese extraction, and he was ready to go to college. Actually, it was the same college that I went to in my undergraduate days, but that long came World War II, and so he volunteered, joined the Navy. And Bill became a Navy signalman, and he went away. He went ashore at Normandy on D-Day on Omaha Beach, and survived. If you saw Steven Spielberg's film Saving Private Ryan, you know what kind of hell that was, and how many men Americans died there. And he came home, became a fifth and sixth grade teacher. In a little country kind of school just near south of our hometown. And when we got to know them, we, of course, lived upstairs. They had divided their house, and upstairs the house was split in two, and there was a doorway between it. And on one side, their sons had their bedrooms. On the other side, we had our apartment, right? And they never locked that door. We always walked through the door. We'd go downstairs then, and we would join them regularly for watching TV and having popcorn. And they invited us to, they taught us all kinds of card games. And they became, for me, surrogate parents. Right? And so sometimes we think, oh, if only I had parents like that. And these were our surrogate parents. Certainly to me, they felt that way. So as we moved on and they moved out, we took over the rest of their house and lived there for a number of years. And then as we moved out of state, you know, it's harder and harder to stay in touch with people. Although whenever we went back to hometown to visit, we moved in with them. We went to their new place. They lived out in the country on a lake, and we slept there just like a family member. And Matthew, our son, used to love go fishing out of that lake. Betty died a couple years ago, and then recently Bill had contracted cancer, stomach cancer, and he was living at home still because his youngest son, Brad, stayed there with him. And Bill was very hard of hearing by this time, so when we tried to call, it was hard to talk to him. He could not hear us, and so we would have to talk to Brad and have Brad pass things along. So I tried to write a couple times to him, and I wrote letters, you know, putting in the usual news. But I never wrote as often as I would have liked. And I recently kept thinking I'm gonna write again. I owe Bill a letter. It's been a couple months now. I should have written this, and you keep putting it off. You know, there's always some reason. You know, I'm too tired. I'm too busy trying to, you know, prepare for work, or we got things to do around the house. And so about 2 weeks ago, I was away from the house, and Sue Ellen got a call from Brad, and Bill had died that day. So it came to me that, I felt this tremendous sense of guilt about, you know, not having written him that last letter, that I had failed him in some sense. And so even though, you know, we have these loved ones, these people close to us, sometimes we don't, you know, it's hard to say I'm sorry. To say that in person, and I wish I'd had the opportunity to tell Bill, I'm sorry, I failed you. I was too lazy to do that. Too many excuses. And I wanted to thank Bill for what he had taught me, for what he had given me and given us in our life. And I wished I could have blessed him with that. I'll tell you one other story. Okay. As I said, that's the hardest sometimes to give a blessing to and to say I'm sorry or thank you to someone that we're really close to. And sometimes the person we're closest to is our mate, okay, our loved one, our spouse, okay? Sulan didn't know I was going to say this, we'll hear about it later. We'll talk about it later, so. But she, that person that you're closest to, it's just that is the problem. You're too close to them. You're too much alike, perhaps. Maybe we're both Helen and I are firstborns, the oldest in the family. We're type A personalities, go get them, go overachieve. Both of us were the type that we sort of glommed onto and loved school because, I couldn't play sports and can't sing worth a darn. So it turned out that I happened to get, loved reading and got along in school, and so did she. So we're very much alike. And of course, when you're, one of those kind of overachievers, you also think you're right, okay, all the time, right? Or almost all the time. And I will tell you this, I know none of this is not true of any of you, but I have on at least one, probably three or four occasions thought that, that in all the arguments and fights and tiffs that we've had in our life, that Sue Ellen almost never apologized to me, but I always was the first one to apologize, and I could count the times on one hand, on the fingers of one hand, that she apologized to me first, right? Now I know she probably thinks that same thing of me, right? So we'll talk about that later too, probably, right? So, but it is hard to say I'm sorry sometimes, even to the person you're closest to. And hard to say thank you sometimes as well. American poet Robert Bly, in his book called A Little Book on the Human Shadow, said that he is a follower of Jung. So he incorporates Jung and Jung's work on myth and fairy tales and so on into his writing. And Robert Bly said that when you're young men, okay, males. When we're going back now to the shadow self, that they take from their shadow, they take their witch. Okay, that part of that is all of us have, that it's the witch, that little creepy old crone that would eat the world, eat the little children, okay, to get what they want. And so males project their witch onto their mother, which I know is true in my case anyway. And little girls project their ogre, the ogre part of us, the little ogre that lives under the bridge, that attacks people, project their ogre onto their fathers. What Bly said was that when a couple does the ceremony to come together and live together, whether married or not, right, that there is an equal and immediate ceremony that happens elsewhere while you're in the church or in the front of the justice of the peace, joining together as husband and wife or as a couple. Okay, back home, wherever you live, in the basement of the garage, there is a parallel ceremony going on where the witch, okay, is transferred from your mother onto your significant other. Okay, and where the ogre is transferred from your father for women onto your male spouse or husband, right? So for years, Sue Ellen has carried my witch. It's a burden that I placed on her. Somebody had to do it. So I want to say I'm sorry, okay, that I put that burden on you. I want to thank you for all the lessons you've given me over the years, helping me to grow and putting up with me, putting up with that burden. I will keep on trying to say I'm sorry and thank you, and I'll stop keeping score.
And I'm sorry, I didn't apologize. Can I tell one thing that Bill said?
Yes, one thing that Bill said.